I tell people all the time, and they don't always know exactly what that means when I say be authentic, but it's be who you are, not who you think other people want you to be. Because that's what's going to create a true human connection and develop levels of trust and foster collaboration.
That is the voice of Dean Hallett, and he'll be joining us on today's Super You podcast.
It's one small step for man.
Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
We choose to go to the moon, not because they are easy, but because they are
hard. I have a dream.
You can't handle the truth.
7.
6.
5.
4.
3.
2.
1.
Super
You. Welcome to today's Super You podcast, a show designed to unlock and unleash your inner superpower on the world. I'm your host, Eric Qualman. A lot of you know me as Equal Man. In this show, the reason we started this show was we were getting so many great tips and tricks from people that we have in studio, thought leaders in studio, as well as when I travel to give keynote speeches, I'm blessed to meet a lot of the top thought leaders in the world, in the green room. And so what I'm trying to do is give you these tips and tricks to help unlock and unleash your inner superpower. We are going to be sitting down with Dean Hallett today, and I believe you're going to get a lot out of this conversation. Dean has spent almost 30 years in the entertainment business, both at Walt Disney and also at Fox, where he served as the CFO as well as the head of strategy. Dean Hallett is currently the president of Hallett Leadership, an organization that develops tomorrow's leaders today, and which supports companies in powerfully transforming their employee cultures from the inside out. In 2017 and 2018, Dean served as Senior Executive Vice President of Operations and Strategy for 20th Century Fox. Prior to 2017, Dean was Executive Vice President, Operations and Strategy, and Chief Financial Officer. During his tenure with Fox, Dean led many enterprise-wide initiatives, including designing and implementing the digital supply chain in Fox Media Cloud, and establishing the company's premier leadership development program. And from 1999 to 2001, Hallett was Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer for Walt Disney Studios. Well, I know I'm super excited to have you on the show today, Dean, with your background at Disney, Fox, and now at Hallett Leadership. I know our audience is going to get a ton out of today's podcast. And just taking a quick step back, obviously we just heard your amazing journey and your amazing bio. Give us it in your own words. How did you get where you are today?
Okay. Yeah. First of all, thanks for having me today. I'm excited about this. I was born in Los Angeles and have lived in the LA area all my life, other than 1 year that I spent in the UK. I went to the University of Southern California out here. And when I was young, my father passed away when I was at a young age. I was about 13 years old, and he had been a big partner in the accounting industry. He worked for one of the big eight firms, and it always just seemed logical to me, based on my skill set and based on the people that I was exposed to through him, that that would be a good career for me. And so I went into public accounting out of school, spent the year overseas with them, which was probably about 6 or 7 years in, and realized the further I got along and the way that industry was changing, that that was not going to be the right culture for me. I went into it thinking, I'll be a partner, I'll be a lifetime partner. And suddenly I was wondering what I was going to be doing with the rest of my life. So I ended up getting recruited by a small public company, but in private industry, called Anthony Industries. Anthony Industries had some recreational and industrial product lines, and one of them, their flagship company initially, was Anthony Pools, and I became the swimming pool group controller, which was something I had never had any exposure to, and learned a lot. It was really interesting coming out of public accounting, not knowing whether I would have practical skills to contribute in a private company, and suddenly I was getting involved in everything from cash flow projections to product liability and lawsuits to how to build the pool better, cheaper, faster. And it really gave me hands-on skills that prepared me for the rest of my career, where I knew with each step I took, I would find ways where I could contribute. I realized about 2.5 years in that the pool business wasn't the long-term business that I wanted. They actually owned K2 snow skis, and you'll probably hear at some point through this conversation what a passionate skier I am. And I wanted the finance job at K2. And once that went away, that opportunity, because they gave it to somebody who'd been at the company much longer, I started thinking about doing something else. And at that time, a friend of mine who had gotten into the headhunting business came to me and started talking to me about a career at Disney. And at first I said, no, I don't really know if I want to go into that kind of company. I hadn't really thought about it. But particularly because the foot in the door that he had was in the audit department. And I had left the world of audit and didn't want to do it anymore. But they had a track record at Disney of taking people from their internal audit group and within a year or two, placing them into business units. So I said, what the heck? Let me go on the interview. I'll see what happens. And I really liked what I saw when I went there. And I ended up going to work for them. Luckily, I only spent 8 months in the audit department. I was doing consumer products licensee audits, and my counterpart was doing all the audits at the studio, and he heard about a job that opened up. So he went to our boss and pitched himself for that job, and the boss thought I was a better fit, and he recommended me for the job. And suddenly, I was the director of finance for motion picture marketing, and kicked off what ended up being a 27-year career in the entertainment industry without even looking for it. It's funny to me because so many times I've come across people that say, oh, I've always wanted to be in the entertainment industry. And literally until that interview, it never even occurred to me to follow that kind of a path. I went in as director of finance and worked my way up through the ranks and ended up becoming the CFO of the studio there. And my counterpart over at Fox was leaving the company, and he had the headhunter reach out to me, and I interviewed with them, and they felt that I was the right fit for them. And the day I walked into the company, I knew it was different, because the chairman who had hired me came up to me, gave me a big hug, and said, welcome to Fox. You're the CFO. You can go to any meeting you want. You can get involved in any project you want. You do not need to ask permission. And I realized how different that culture was from Disney. And it gave me an opportunity to play in areas as a CFO that I had never participated in. And I was able to expand my role over a number of years to the point where I was doing designing digital supply chains, doing training and development, doing all kinds of different things over the course of 17 years at Fox, and only left there about a year and a half ago to when I saw the Disney acquisition of Fox coming, I felt it was the right time for me to leave. And so I chose to leave and start my own enterprise, as you mentioned, Hallett Leadership, about January of this year. And so I'm doing training development now for people in all kinds of industries in a program that is and ways of coaching and things like that that I was doing inside of Fox for probably about 15 years.
No, that's great. And I'm wondering, it would be really helpful for our audience out there, because a lot of our listeners, all of us really, but I know that some of our listeners right now are faced with that decision where they're going to basically change their career / change their life. And through the course of your journey, just the short, brief explanation you just gave is that there's a couple points. One, we're leaving the world of audit and then going into work at a pool for pools where you don't know anything. And then secondarily, when you go, I'm going to take a chance and just go back into audit, but then I'm going to jump into the world of entertainment, even though in your mind, you never thought you'd ever jump into the world of entertainment. Is there anything that would be helpful for our listeners out there to where they're faced with that decision right now? They might not be happy with their current job, or they're just given a certain opportunity that might not be able to resist. Are there any things that could help that person make that decision that you found personally?
I think it's interesting. Those were two distinct times in my career when those changes occurred. I think the first one the smart thing that I did in my situation was by going to Anthony, I went to work with a small management team where we were all in it together. And I felt that I would be mentored effectively. So I felt if I had gone to Disney directly out of audit, I honestly think I would have failed miserably because I would have been a little fish in the sea, not really knowing where I was going to be able to add value, not knowing where to jump in. And by going into a small group where I felt I was part of something and involved in so many different decisions, it really gave me a sense of the big picture of the company. I started to see how everything fit together and where I could make a difference and how I could be a contributor that way. When I went to Disney, going back into audit was probably smart because it gave me an opportunity to establish myself in the company in an area of expertise I already had. And then when I went into the entertainment side of the business, I think I'd say there's two components I think that really helped me. One is that I was in my 20s, I did a self-awareness personal growth training program. Today, I guess that would be called an emotional intelligence program. And I got in touch with the skills and the talents and the gifts that I have that I could bring to the world. And I had somebody who helped me really figure out how to take those and integrate them into what I did in the business world. So when I ended up going to Disney and becoming director of finance in motion picture marketing, it was imperative that I would be able to communicate with creative types, which I had never done before, and not just come off as the finance Gestapo or something like that. And I learned to establish a relationship. I learned to collaborate with them. We learned how to work together to make great creative materials at the same time, find an efficient way to do it. And those communication skills, so developing those communication skills were valuable. And the second piece of that is being myself. I tell people all the time, you know, and they don't always know exactly what that means when I say be authentic, but it's be who you are, not who you think other people want you to be. Because that's what's going to create a true human connection and develop levels of trust and foster collaboration. And if you want to be in an environment where you can thrive, the only way you're really going to truly feel good about that is if you're able to be yourself. I find it takes a tremendous amount of energy for me to be anything other than myself. So by being able to be authentic in that environment and taking those communication skills that I had learned, I was able to be successful. So it's not just about the technical skills. It's truly about how to work with other people in teams and collaborate and communicate effectively.
And then, Dean, you mentioned you took a self-awareness test or what we call a EQ or emotional intelligence test today. I don't know if you remember the name of that test or the person that helped you, but are there any tips and tricks or tools that you could give to our audience on trying to do that self-awareness? Because some of us out there, we actually wrestle with, we don't know who we are. So we're trying to figure out, be self-aware in order to succeed. If there's anything along those lines, or even if you remember the test you took, sure, that'd be helpful.
Yeah, it actually wasn't a test. It was actually a program. It was the first one was 3 nights and then a weekend. And then the second one was 5 full days. It was a program, an experiential program. And back then, a program I took was called LifeSpring. That program is no longer around by that name. There is a program that is almost identical to it that I'm aware of called MITT. I think it's Masters in Transformational Training. I know they're based here out of the Los Angeles area, but I do believe they do trainings in different parts of the country. And I, through that process, through those trainings, I met someone by the name of Jack Swizig, who he's my mentor, my coach. And he is the one who really has worked with me over the years. We're still very dear friends. And he's the one who worked with me over the years on how to take what I had learned through those programs and integrate them into how I execute in my job and my career.
No, that's great. And that, we'll put that in the show notes. It's MITT. We'll put those in the show notes. And it's wonderful to have a mentor like Jack Swizig. So that's most of the folks that we interview with, they have that mentor out there. And another common thread that we've seen that you've hit the nail on the head is really just around, to succeed, you really need to be yourself. In order to do that, you have to have self-awareness. Now, you've come across so many CEOs and top performers, not only in your career, but also now that you have Hallett Leadership. Are there other common traits or habits or threads that seem to be common amongst these top performers?
I think leaders that are truly themselves, that people feel they can connect with and they can trust and they're willing to open up with, are the most effective leaders, because those people can rally a team and foster an environment of collaboration where people are willing to work together, willing to make mistakes and support each other. But it's not just authenticity alone. I think there has to be a vision, passion, something that goes with it. Because somebody can be themselves and be great to be around, but they need to have a vision that you want to follow them on. I think Tom Rothman, who was one of the chairmen that I worked for at Fox, was the epitome of that. When I used to do some of these leadership workshops and so forth at Fox, one of the things I would have them watch was a video by Brené Brown called The Power of Vulnerability. And at the end of the video, a number of people would say, well, that's great. Yeah, it's nice to be vulnerable, but you can't do that in the workplace. And I said, really? I said, do you know anybody here at our company that is open and vulnerable like that, that has been very successful? And inevitably, we would get to Tom Rothman, that chairman. And people would acknowledge that he was himself. He was open. He was vulnerable. He was emotional. But he was passionate, and he had a vision, and he would... his true self would come through in all the communication. So I think authenticity is essential these days. And there's some companies that can go for a while, but ultimately I think the companies will have cultural challenges in the rank and file if they don't have an authentic leader.
No, that's great insight. And we love Brené Brown. We've had her on the show twice now. She's the two-time repeat offender. She's wonderful. So I love the
vulnerability. Yeah, she's great. I love listening to her.
Yeah, no, she's wonderful. I love that you mentioned, vulnerability. I can't do that in the workplace. I remember Sean Acker, he's a great writer on happiness. And so I was talking to him. He goes, well, I speak on happiness. This was 12 years ago. I kind of go, well, good luck with that, with these banks. But everyone wants to be happy. So kudos to Sean, who's just taking it to a whole new level. Now, if you look across there, so when you see on the other side, someone that's underperforming, because a lot of us have teams, it might be a team of one, it might be a team like you did, which can range in the thousands, the hundreds. What do you do with someone that's underperforming? What's a common thread you see of someone that's underperforming? Is there a way to solve for it?
I don't know if in every case it's solvable, but typically when I see people that are underperforming, or even if I look at times in my career where I feel like things haven't been clicking right, what I usually find, and there's some aspect of them being isolated or being self-righteous about things or not reaching out and asking for help and connecting with other people, unwilling to step out of their comfort zone and try new ways of doing things. And the way that I have seen there be some form of success with those people is initially some form of feedback. I think feedback is probably the most underused, most cost-efficient management tool that we have available to us. And so many companies, so many people seem to be afraid of it. And I think it's an incredibly valuable tool. When people are isolated, and if I think part of the challenge is some people sometimes feel that they don't know how to not take feedback personally. If we can get them past that hurdle, or the person giving it feels that it's too personal, if you can get past that hurdle and create an environment where people are willing to give and receive feedback, it can make a real difference in how people start working with others, and then people almost feel like they have a support group. I would actually run an exercise with my team. Periodically, I would know that it was time to do something with my team, because people would come into my office and start complaining, like so-and-so's doing this, or they're not sharing this information, or they're being this way again. And if I heard too much of that, I said, okay, it's time. And I would take my team, and they would think we're just going to do one of our normal update meetings, And I would run an exercise, and I would just put questions on the board and have them mingle with each other and get to as many people as I can and just answer questions, fill in the blanks, like what I admire you about you as a manager is, what I think would make you a better manager is, and structure the questions in such a way that these people who were in my office complaining would have an opportunity to communicate directly with those people to say what they had to say. And some people didn't like the bit of confrontational feeling that it had in the moment, but inevitably, whenever we completed those processes, people would come to me and say, you know, either I love doing those things or I don't like doing those things, but you know what? It was so good. I feel we're all on the same page now. And it just sort of cleared the air. And I think when you have people that are underperforming, the same kind of benefit can happen. If they're willing to listen about, I'm sure you're familiar with the Johari window. And for your listeners that may not be, it's a matrix that basically on one grid says, here's what I see or don't see about myself. And on the other side, other axis, here's what other people see or don't see. And one of those quadrants is the quadrant that I don't see, but others do. And it's a blind spot for me. And if I'm willing to listen to people give me feedback, I can learn something about myself, or at the very least learn something about how others are perceiving me, whether it is or is not true. I can then make a choice to change my behavior, change the way I'm dealing with people to rectify that issue that seems to be getting in the way between me and others.
I think you're right on. When to use your words, is that feedback's the greatest tool we don't utilize. And there's so many companies that do 1 year reviews, and that's insane when these are your people to just take it 1 year to have that review when you have that constant feedback. So I love what you do and change things up, which as you mentioned, self-awareness is key for all of us to have success out there. Now, if you're
not only on the 1 year review, it's not just that it's only 1 year, it's also going to then be tied to your increase.
Right, so it's tied to your financial.
People are going to be reluctant to give bad feedback because they don't want to be responsible for somebody getting a bad increase.
No, you're right. Plus, there's just anxiety. If it's only happening once a year, it's like I've got to go in and my bonus is tied to this and my financial increase is tied to this potential meeting, even though it's
exactly.
For the whole year. That's really well said. There's actually apps out there. You probably know this. There's some companies that I've seen that have basically it texts these people real time, especially Gen Y and Gen Z. How you feeling 1 to 10? And so they're constantly having these feedback loops using technology. And then obviously when needed, you can't replace face-to-face. Then they'll sit down and have face-to-face informal meetings as well. The best companies do that. And the best teams seem to do that, to have that constant feedback loop.
Right.
So that's a huge learning that you've seen in your career. If you were during the 20s, you mentioned that you go, you know, I got to kind of take a step back and just kind of do some self-awareness. If you were to text yourself, your 20-year-old self, some advice, what would you text your 20-year-old self?
Yeah, I'm going to sound a little bit like a broken record. I think the first thing I would say, probably two things. First thing I would say is be who you are, not who you think others want you to be. It is what makes you unique. It's what makes you special. You got people coming out of school that are well-trained technically, and they're trying to establish themselves, they're trying to get jobs, and what sets them apart is who they are. And you want the right culture in companies these days, and companies want the right people coming into that culture that are a fit. And so they're going to want to know what somebody truly is like in order to see whether they are a fit in that culture. And with the amount of disruption that companies are facing today, it's essential that you keep the right culture where everybody is working together collaboratively, sharing points of view. And to the degree that somebody coming out of school is willing to be themselves and let others see who they are, that's going to resonate with certain companies, and people are going to realize that that's what makes them different than other candidates that they're seeing and could lead to a hire. So, and if I'm myself in one of those environments, then I'm going to be more comfortable. I'm going to feel more natural day to day with all those hours that I'm spending at the job. So, that's the first thing. The other one kind of goes back to what I was saying about how I sort of fell into entertainment. I really, as I left Fox, I wanted to look and see what I wanted to do. And somebody said, well, why don't you just take and create a list of the 50 companies you'd like to work for? And I thought that was such a simple, brilliant idea, as opposed to me thinking about what's the position that I want and then going out and doing a search to see who has those positions available. I think people should think about what role they want, not just the role, but what company lines up with their passions, and then look and see what roles they have available and see if their skill set fits what those roles are. Because that's going to be something, again, that they're going to feel better about in terms of the environment they're in, who they're working with, what the values of the company are, what the company is. It's going to resonate with them more day to day than just finding a position that happens to be in some industry making widgets that they don't care about.
And speaking of entertainment, you have been at the epicenter of entertainment, obviously live right there as well in Los Angeles. For some of us outsiders to the entertainment world, is there something that you commonly hear that people believe about the entertainment world that's either untrue or just false, or something you go, hey, those that aren't in entertainment don't know this?
I think we live in a pretty transparent world these days. Nothing pops to mind. I mean, when you ask me that question, sort of the opposite pops to mind is what is really true, which is I think there's a lot of the entertainment industry that lives in a bubble and believe that they are in tune with what's happening in the rest of the world, but they are really more in tune with what's happening in their bubble of the world and don't truly have a sense of what others are going through in their lives because their lives are so different. And that's something I saw lots of people where their entire life was the entertainment industry. Their entire identity was built into the entertainment industry. And to me, it was a great career. Don't misunderstand. I loved my career in the entertainment industry, but it was a career. It was not who I was in terms of my entire identity is in the entertainment industry, because then when you leave it, then what do you have? And so I think that there's a disconnect. There's more than a bit of a disconnect, I think, in the entertainment industry versus what I would call the real world, that is an issue at times, for sure.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people, especially in this day and age, when someone asks them, you know, who are you, they'll define themselves by what they do. And then the person will say, no, that's what you do. Like, who are you? It sounds like you're able to distance yourself while you loved it. You loved it. And you loved your career. Are there any tips to kind of help us ensure that that's not 100% of our being is wrapped around what we do as a vocation?
I think that comes through balance. You know, I watch people in the entertainment industry, you know, breakfast, lunch, dinners, every breathing moment was tied into what they were working on. I made it a point when my kids were in their years of doing sports and so forth. I was the CFO at Disney, and I made it a point to get out of there. I was the manager of a club soccer team, and they practiced 2 days a week. I made sure I was there at least one day each week in the afternoon for those practices to stay connected to my family, stay connected to my kids, and enjoy that part of my life. I made it a point to take my vacations. I made it like I said, I'm an avid skier. I go heli-skiing every year. I've skied every year since I was 4 years old. I don't want to give that up. So it's about balance. There's an expression of, you know, some people live to work. I work to live. And that's how I approach my career. It was a career so that I could have a life that has a tremendous amount of meaning to me. And so that's, I think, balance is a key factor.
And I think a lot of folks, they wrestle with it. So you're the manager of the soccer team. You go, I can't do that because if I do that, then I might lose my job, or I might get demoted, or I might not get that promotion. Where sometimes, did you find the inverse was true? It actually made you stronger at your job day to day by taking those breaks and also setting that line saying, hey, I'm not going to be at that meeting at 5 o'clock because I have to go coach the soccer team.
I do think it gave me a same thing with the taking my vacations. I came back fresh, new perspectives, especially as I get further in my career and I'm responsible for strategy. Sometimes if I'm in the details day in and day out, it's hard for me to take a step back and have a fresh or an open perspective on things. So I think it really does make a difference to do those things. There is that element, I think, of guilt. I certainly had it lots of times where I feel like You know, are people going to think? It's more about the perception. I felt guilty if people had the wrong perception about me because I knew how hard I worked. So I wasn't feeling guilty that I wasn't working in that moment, but I felt like people might look at me and think I'm not working hard or I'm not taking it seriously. And at some point I realized that that was probably a lot more me than it was the people that would be perceiving me. It was more in my head. And I think in today's world where you have people that are working from home, flexible hours, all these different opportunities, I think people have more of an opportunity now to be able to have the balance that they want in their life without having that concerned or guilty feeling.
Yeah, someone told me once that a lot of times you have guilt either way. You're going to feel guilty because the team's perception of you, or you're going to feel guilty if you don't go and coach the soccer team, that you're going to feel guilty because you think you should be there. You know you should be
right
there with the kids. And so what he told me was, I can live with the guilt from the team. I can't live with the guilt from my family. So I love what you said there. That's amazing. Do you remember any of the team soccer names? I know we always have some fun soccer names with my kids where we've got Rainbow Warriors and Cotton Candy Lollipops.
Yeah, we had Blue Lightning, Red Lasers. My daughter had Purple Dolphins. Ultimately, when they played at the club level, they had the club name, which we were down in Brea in Orange County, and it was the Brea Blaze. But we did let them choose the names.
That's great. It's a good memory. Purple Dolphins. I love it.
Yeah.
And then switching gears, you mentioned strategy. So when you talk about strategy in your career, obviously you're helping set strategy, and you helped set the strategy when you're at Disney and Fox for essentially the entire, you helped shape what media looks like today, what global media looks like today. As you look ahead into the future, where do you think media is going?
Directionally, I know where it's going. I think it's a constant battle to figure out exactly what that looks like. You know, you can go back just a couple of years and think, oh, it's all about subscription and it's Netflix. But now even Netflix is being disrupted by Disney Plus and some of the other subscription services. And I think potentially being disrupted by what I would call subscription saturation. I think it was CBS that came out recently and said, well, we think everybody's going to have 10 subscriptions. And I just don't see that. I think maybe your early adopters or your heavy users might have 10 subscriptions, but I don't think middle America is going to have 10 subscriptions. I think they're going to pick maybe 3 or 4, and they're going to look to get the rest of their entertainment some other way. And companies are going to try to find out what that niche is. There are companies out there that are dealing with and trying out the idea of touchscreen purchasing in a show as the technology gets better and better. If I'll give you an example, if I like hip hop and I'm watching some hip hop 10-minute episode and I like some jacket some guy's wearing, I can hit a button and say order that jacket so quickly that it won't really even take me out of the episode. So over the top, on demand, short form where you can watch it during an Uber ride, I think that's the direction of where consumption is going. I think it's a real challenge for the movie industry because there's so much good entertainment in the home and on the phone, all of the things that it takes. You're seeing it happen already. I mean, Disney's brilliant at it in buying Marvel and Lucas and Pixar and all those key brands where they are making the movies when people are making choices, I'm only going to go to so many movies a year now, those are the ones they're going to go see. And so they've got a dominant position in the marketplace. I think they're at 42% of the box office this summer. So that's going to be a challenge for studios that aren't making that kind of branded content. And so I think it's a challenge for the movie business overall, particularly for certain studios that don't have the branded entertainment. And I think there are upcoming challenges for even subscription services that think that was the new way and what they had to do. I think they're going to find themselves struggling because not as many people as they're hoping will either take up a subscription with them or maintain that subscription with them over time.
No, it's well said. I agree with that. Is that if you look at even when the internet first exploded, it is that people thought, oh, everyone's going to go to these multiple websites. Then we looked at the research, they weren't going to 20, 50 websites. They were going to 3 to 6 consistently.
Right.
So we've kind of,
right.
Yeah.
And now these are ones they're talking about having to pay for, right? And their whole idea is they don't want a $150 cable bill. They want to pay, you know, $30, $3, $10 subscriptions, and they want to be done.
And are there any other, it might be in the entertainment industry or might be outside of it, just anything. This is a wild card, just toss up. Is there any known truth, like people just perceive it to be, hey, this is accepted, that you disagree with?
I don't, not specific to the entertainment industry. I think I would go back to the leadership area. And I, one of the things that I hear, I still hear people say, and I don't believe it's inherently true, is that extroverts make better leaders. I think that the loudest person in the room is not necessarily the best leader. They might want the most airtime. In the work that I've done over the last 15 years, I've made it a point in what I do and what I teach people to do to be sure they solicit the input of the introverts in the room. I think they have tremendous ideas that don't get brought out, and they are leaders in their own style. And if you get them comfortable with that and get them comfortable, not becoming an extrovert, but being comfortable in having unsolicited input into something so that their idea can get tossed around on the table, they'll get more comfortable in the level of contribution they make, and therefore get more comfortable in their ability to lead and have vision and have ideas. And I think there's already a change happening where people are really trying to pull out those ideas. And I think that comes back to what I said before about there's so much disruption out there that it's coming at us constantly that we really have to get so many different points of view to, because we don't have the bandwidth. We don't have the sensory perception to see everything ourselves. We have to get as much input as possible in order to be able to have the best response or have the best strategy. And to the degree we can get that input that's been residing within those introverts, I think it's essential. And as I said, going through that process with them over the last 10, 15 years, I have seen these people move up the leadership ladder more effectively. So I think they have tremendous leadership skills. They don't require the airtime. And sometimes that's better. Sometimes some people like a calm leader who isn't pushing, but calm leader who's empowering people to get things done and is there as a supportive coach when they want them to be.
Yeah, and I think with people like you out there pushing that message, and also just the research is starting to show it more and more, people are starting to understand that, yes, most of us perceive this amazing leader to be like a Richard Branson or Mark Cuban because it makes sense because they're in the media because they're extroverts. When the research shows the majority of CEOs that are successful are actually introverted by nature. And then the other good thing that we're starting to see, which you know better than most, is that a lot of us are actually both. We're introverted and extroverted, depending on what role we're playing in that particular moment. So, no, that's really good insight.
Now, I think that goes back to getting more comfortable with your own style and being able to move on that range from one end to the other, depending upon the circumstances. You're right. We all have introversion and extroversion within us.
And I always like to ask this question because, I mean, just looking at your career is amazing. Is there any, it could be inside the career or outside, is there any particular story you'd love to tell the audience?
You know, in the entertainment industry, there's always something that happens that's really interesting. I'll share one story that I won't disclose the name of who the talent was, but we were making a film. And we were in a room in a marketing meeting, and our chairman would always sit right next to the phone in that room. And anytime the phone rang, you knew it was for him. And one day the phone rang, and it's always his assistant that would call. And he picks up the phone, and he says, "Hello," and you just hear him go, "No, you can't do." And he slams the phone down, and he goes into this tirade. He says, "We have this problem with this star. He keeps getting involved. He's creating disruption. We can't get the shoots done. It's just ridiculous what we're going through." He is right in the middle of his rant, and this star opens the door and walks in the room. So clearly his assistant said he was at his office. I don't know if he knew he was coming down the hall or not. As the door opens and he walks in, the chairman goes like in a split second from his rant to so-and-so, how you doing? Goes up, gives him a big hug, talks about how the, and he knew exactly how to diffuse the situation because he said, these are the people right here in this room that are responsible for marketing your movie. They're the best in the business. And he just completely eliminated the possibility of the star walking in and creating a bad situation. After he left the room, the chairman shared with us that what was happening was this star literally was getting on the set every morning, spending 2 hours trying to get changes into the script, change the way the movie was being done. And you know, if, I don't know if you know film production, but you probably do. There's hundreds of people standing around that are getting paid and they're not producing anything. And so the chairman went to him and he said, here's the deal. And this was a movie we're making. The movie was, I think, pretty close to $100 million movie. And we were about halfway in. And the chairman went up to him and he said, here's the deal. We can shut this movie down tomorrow. He said, we will live to fight another day. We will make more movies. We will lose $50 million. You, on the other hand, will never work another day in Hollywood if that happens. So get on the set, say your lines. When people are there to work, that's what you need to do. If you want to come and you want to talk about the script, do that on your own time. Most chairmen wouldn't do that. That was Tom Rothman, the one who I said was authentic. He was willing to put himself out there and to do what he had to do in order to get things on the right track. And I think that inspired people that if a situation's not working, somebody needs to step up and deal with it. Because in Hollywood, that doesn't always happen.
No, it's so true. And just at the time of this podcast recording, we see it with the National Football League with Antonio Brown, the wide receiver for the Raiders, just a malcontent. And finally, the Raiders, to their credit, said, here's the line in the sand. We're not putting up with this anymore. You can do this or that. And so they eventually wind up cutting the best wide receiver in football, arguably. So I think sometimes you have to do that authenticity, because even if you kept that player, you'd lose the team. Like the Raiders would have lost the entire team. In this instance, it sounded like the chairman probably lost the respect of people in that room. So that, I love that story. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. That was fun to watch.
And then speaking of leaders, you might not have a story around this guy. You might, but were there any good Walt Disney stories that kind of permeated the walls there?
You know, I don't really have a story on Walt Disney himself. I think what was interesting that I watched happen was when I first went to the company, one of the greatest things when I first went to Disney was you go to this orientation, you sat down, they show you a 20-minute video, and it was Michael Eisner and Frank Wells, and they basically laid the foundation. They said, we're all here, we're all a team, we're on a first name basis, you see me, you call me Michael, you see me, you call me Frank. So all that stuff got out of the way, and they were a good balance for each other. The way I heard the story was Frank Wells originally got the job and they were bringing in Michael as either an equal or a number two. And Michael, half kidding, said, okay, I'll come, but only if I'm number one. And they went to Frank and Frank said, yeah, fine with me. And you saw this dynamic where Michael, who was an idea a minute, and not all of them were great, but he would walk into a room and he'd come up with all these ideas about things to do. And then Frank, after Michael left the room, would say, okay, ignore these seven ideas and just do these three. And I don't know if that was the right way to do a partnership, but it seemed to work for them. And the company was very effective. That's when they built the brands that had been sitting there idle for so long. Frank Wells was killed in a helicopter crash. And after that, there was really no counter to Michael. And so he would still come into these rooms and put out all these ideas. And there was a lot of running around chasing ideas that didn't make sense. So I think that was what created a culture within Disney that wasn't right for me, because there were too many people sort of running around, pitted against each other, and not a real feeling that there was a strategic direction for a period of time there. Bob Iger, on the other hand, is a master at it. He has not only bought the right brands, he also I talked to somebody who worked there. He goes, I was getting so sick and tired of Bob Iger telling us what the strategy was, telling us what the vision was. It's like, enough already. I've heard it. And then what this person said they realized was thousands of people were starting to say the same thing because Bob Iger said it until it resonated with people, until people bought into it, until they believed it. And then he no longer had to be the only champion of it. He had champions throughout the company that were speaking the same language. And if you want to know something that Disney does great, it's they have mandates. And that was one of the challenges that we had at Fox was we didn't. Rupert Murdoch's statement was more along the lines of do whatever it takes to make your business successful. And so we had a lot of internal energy expended fighting each other in the streets, so to speak, to get our business ahead of somebody else's business within the company. Iger establishes what those priorities are. Maybe they don't have as much involvement. Maybe people don't feel they have as much of a voice. But once they have that mandate, they have that vision in place, they have that strategy in place, everybody's aligned and they're going in that direction. And that is a really efficient use of energy.
Yeah, I love that. It's Bob Iger saying, here's the island, and then we're going to row all right. together to get that island, then probably give you some freedom on how you row. But to your point is that it was funny at Ford, when Alan Mulally took over at Ford, he wanted to go to one Ford, one platform, meaning the cars are going to be built on one platform, and we're probably going to sell off some of these other brands just to get to that one Ford. And ad nauseum, he just repeated one Ford, and had these plastic plates made up with one Ford on them and made all the employees carry them with them. And if you didn't have it on you and Alan caught you not having it on you, then he had a bunch in his pocket. He'd hand one to you to make sure that you had it with you. So there's no mystery why Bob Iger's been so successful at Disney. So that's great, great insight. As we wrap things up here, obviously we always want to hear what you do in terms of, is there a book, is there a certain movie or a poem or a place that you'd like to recommend to our audience so that they can maybe pick up that book or use that saying or go to that location or watch that film?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a book that ties right in with what I'm doing right now, and it's very simplistic. It's called Collaboration Begins With You. It's by Ken Blanchard, who did The 1 Minute Manager, and it's written in a parable, and it really simplifies that if you're sitting in a company and it feels like there's just this top down messaging that's coming in, there's not a lot of collaboration and teamwork, don't wait for it to come from the top. There are so many things that you can do within the rank and file, within your own smaller team, within a group, where you can be the person that reaches out to somebody else and says, let's brainstorm on how we can work more effectively together. Let's look at this together and use, you know, both of our brains or a group of people's brains to figure out how to solve a problem and not wait for someone else to come along and give you the assignment to do that. Like I said, there's so much disruption coming at all of us that we're going to come up with better outcomes most of the time when we're all working together. And if we can all take the initiative to do that ourselves, it makes life a lot easier. So Collaboration Begins With You is a great start.
Collaboration Begins With You. And also, Dean, what are you doing right now? What are you excited about? Tell the audience, what are you doing right now? What are you excited about over the next 12 months? And if there's any ask for our audience out there.
I'm excited. I started my own company back in January where I've taken these training programs that I've been referencing. And I've did them within Fox for 15 years. Now I'm taking them out to the world, to any industry. I think leadership, high-performance leadership is what I'm developing. I call it developing tomorrow's leaders today. The key program that I do runs 9 months long, and I work essentially side by side with a group of middle to upper management in a company so that over the course of 9 months, the leadership characteristics and traits and behaviors and collaboration and all those different things become ingrained in their day-to-day activities so that by the end of 9 months, it's just natural for them to continue working that way. I see too many weekend or 1 week workshops and things like that where people get great insights and then they go back to their other ways of doing things. So that's what I'm excited about. What I like more than anything else these days is being able to work with a group of people and help them learn lessons in a much faster way than I did and watch their growth and transformation happen. So I'm really excited. I had the opportunity after leaving Fox of saying, what do I want to do now? And I spent a little time really soul searching and trying to understand what makes me tick and what really turns me on right now. And it's being able to help people develop those characteristics and get in touch with what they're really capable of as quickly as possible. Life is short, and to the sooner they get in touch with who they are, the more fun they're going to have, I think, throughout their life.
No, life is short, and I know you've helped so many people, and now you're continuing to help so many people. So I know how busy you are, so I just want to say thank you for taking so much time here today to help our audience. Really appreciate it. We ran the gamut from Walt Disney to Michael Eisner to Rupert Murdoch to Purple Dolphins, so I loved it. And so thanks again for your time.
Well, thank you, Eric. This has been great. It's been an honor spending the time with you.
No, thank you. That's it for today's Super You podcast. Thank you for joining us. I also want to give a huge thanks to Dean Hallett for joining us. To find out more about what Dean's up to, feel free to visit his website. It's HallettLeadership.com, H-A-L-L-E-T-T, Leadership.com. Thank you for listening to today's Super You podcast. This is Equal Man reminding all of us, until next time, it's not what we take from the world, it is what we leave behind.
7.
6.
5.
4.
3.
2.
1.
Super, 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 super.
Super You.